Good morning. This is Joel Hodson, creator of Mystery Science Theater 3000, and you're listening to Too Much Scrolling. See you in the future.
Welcome to Too Much Scrolling for February 8th, 2022. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Eros, God of Love.
We're just a couple of guys sitting around talking about things that are important to us. Hopefully they're important to you. And if you need more information, there's so many great ways to find more information. Eros, the God of Love, you're just in time for Valentine's Day. I don't know if you're aware of Valentine.
I am aware of Valentine's Day. That's the reason why I have this bow and arrow and also this fire with me, because, you know, a little desire going on here. So I do want to just say many people don't recognize me this year. I look a little different. I look a lot like Harry Styles.
Film at 11. Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. I have gotten the chance to see I don't know if I would call it a miniseries. There was an 8-episode show on Netflix this week that just came out. It's called The Woman in the House Across the Street from the Girl in the Window. And that's what I've been watching this week on Netflix.
Well, it stars Kristen Bell, Steve, so tell us a little bit about it.
That's all you need to know. That's all you need to know is Kristen Bell. Kristen Bell, America's sweetheart, she is adorable, and she is in a situation in this movie where she is suffering from the loss of a child, and she's sitting in her window in her house, and across the street, a handsome young man moves in, and she's staring through the window, and she witnesses a gruesome murder. Or is it a gruesome murder? Is Kristen Bell's character's imagination getting away from her? She is in the middle of grief and stress and depression, and the question of this story is whether or not you can believe what you see. Let's just say she's bought a set of wine glasses that can fit a whole bottle of wine, and she is drinking a lot of wine and taking some medication, and her idea of what's happening might not actually be what's happening. This is one of your least favorite storytelling conventions, Chip. This is the unreliable narrator. The whole time, the audience is really trying to understand what's really happening through the eyes of Kristen Bell's character.
Was it well done?
It is intriguing. It is an 8-episode, 4 hours, 30 minutes per episode, intriguing murder mystery. It's a satire of other murder mysteries, especially The Girl on the Train that was published in 2015. This character, we are pulling for her. We want her to succeed, but we're not sure what it is that we're seeing. So when we get to the Mark Evan Jackson scene, where he shows up and is a very comedic lighthouse manager, we're still not sure what we're looking at. Those of you who watched The Good Place with Kristen Bell, Mark Evan Jackson played a demon in that show. And so we see the interaction of these two actors that we love, and we're still trying to figure out this murder mystery.
Is this a comedy?
It's not. This is not a comedy. It's not. It is not played for laughs, but the things that happen in it are so ludicrous that my wife and I laughed out loud at the ridiculousness of some of the action. Will Ferrell did executive produce this, so there is a flavor of writing from a Will Ferrell type style, but it is definitely not a comedy. It's a satire, but not laugh out loud.
So, and this is asking you to watch 8 30-minute episodes, so it's 4 hours. Should this have been a movie?
It may have been better as a movie, because I'll tell you what, at the end of the 4 hours, my wife and I both looked at the screen, threw our hands in the air, and went, what? How did we watch 4 hours of this just now? It's really riveting. The acting is superb, but the whole time you're second guessing everything that you're seeing on screen, and by the end you're still not sure that what you saw is what really happened, because even in the post-credit scene, the Kristen Bell character has one more delusion that she thinks she sees something, and the audience sees it because it was filmed, and then all of the other characters tell her that that did not happen. So we still don't know, even 4 hours later.
Would you recommend this?
Yes, surprisingly, I would recommend this. Anybody who loves murder mysteries, all of you who have been paying attention to all the murder mysteries that we've been reading lately on this show and in Sandwiches at Irregular Hours, this is a send-up, a satire of those types of books. And it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun, and it's kind of frustrating at the same time, kind of like life.
Well, Steve, this is not the only thing you got to see this week. What else did you watch?
My 16-year-old son decided that we needed to watch the Impractical Jokers movie. This was released in 2020. It is the movie, the multi-million dollar film from those silly guys, the Impractical Jokers. Are you familiar with the Impractical Jokers, Chip?
I'm not. Was there a movie about them a couple years ago?
No, I don't think so. They produced this very silly, very kind of web-based show called Impractical Jokers, where they sit in a room with microphones and have an earpiece in one of the actors' ears and tell them what to say and do in ridiculous situations. It's kind of like this generation's Candid Camera, where they are fooling strangers who wander by and do ridiculous things and compete for who can get through these challenges with these strangers.
And this is for humor.
This, yes.
This is supposed to be funny. Yes. Okay.
This is very much the Candid Camera making fun of real life, having these silly people out there doing ridiculous things and seeing if they can get each other to laugh while they're whispering in their ear ridiculous things to say to strangers.
So, was it enjoyable? Is it funny?
It was fun. It was fun. We rented it on Amazon for 99 cents, and since my wife and I and our 16-year-old sat and watched it, for 99 cents, it was valuable. It was well worth 33 cents a piece.
All right.
I don't know if I can argue that everybody should watch it, but I'll tell you what, the editing genius of this is really on display. This is Thomas Voigt, who is the editor of South Park and the South Park movies, and Team America World Police. So if you like those sorts of crude humor, you'll see that genius of editing here, where they took hours of footage and crammed it down into a reasonable storyline. You got a chance to see something much more serious, much more practical than I saw. You watched Soros from 2019. Tell us all about that one.
I did. This was a movie that I had been wanting to watch, and I finally got an opportunity to watch it. It is a documentary. It's about George Soros. Many people consider, or at least in circles, consider him a very evil person. He's a very wealthy financier. From Hungary, Steve, originally he was, forced out. His parents were forced out during the Holocaust. Okay. So he is a person much like the Koch brothers, who's thought of as kind of a meddler into different parts of the world. His money has allowed him to have influence. So Soros has a really interesting direction on what he wants to accomplish. And usually it's protecting some minority group from a majority rule. And so you become, as you're watching this, very sympathetic to them. So I came into this film thinking that, oh, there would be some kind of, this is going to be very interesting. Let's figure out why he's thought of as such a meddler and not necessarily given a spotlight on in a very positive light. And I left this thinking, oh, what an interesting person. So he reminds me of a lot of people who have become very wealthy in their life, and they want to get involved in a lot of things that they feel matters. So you could easily see a film like this being about Gates, you know, or the Gates Foundation. You could see this about, you know, what I don't see this is Warren Buffett. There's been stuff about Warren Buffett, but it's just still about his investing. Soros may have gotten a charge out of investing, becoming wealthy at one time. He's a hedge fund. He ran that. But really, his legacy is to go around the world to help groups who are usually minorities protect their right of life, their ability to exist, any number of things. And I think that you should watch this. Now, we have to be aware that anytime you watch a documentary, certainly that is a very positive about a person. Yeah, they probably had a hand in making that positive feeling. But I left this understanding where he came from, what his drive was to become wealthy, and then how he wants to use it. So if there was some group out there that's being marginalized, that's small, that doesn't have resources, one of the stories they tell is some group, they asked, well, what would you need in resources? And the lady said, well, $10,000. And he goes, you got to think bigger. Because he's throwing around millions of dollars. Now, does he have influence in the United States politics? Possibly. He seems to have funds a lot of things. There are things that you know, they say that he funds, and they don't know where the money comes from. Well, it could be George Soros. Good or bad, he is a person that wants to take marginalized groups, and he wants to provide seed money to allow them to protect themselves. Certainly worth your time kind of exploring his thoughts. I left this like I left reading a book about the Koch brothers, understanding a lot more of what they wish to put their resources behind. And I was once again much more sympathetic to him, and you know what a blessing it is to have resources to be able to have an influence like that. So very worthwhile your time. It came out in 2019. It's available on all your streaming services.
Interesting. That's intriguing to think about the influences of people around the world and what finance can do to influence everything.
Well, it's not uncommon. Ben Franklin, the first part of his life, became incredibly wealthy. His second part of his life, he used it to make a difference in the world. The American Revolution was, you know, had a lot to do with Ben Franklin and his views of the world. I mean, you think of Carnegie, a person who became very, very wealthy. You know, how many areas of the world or of the United States have a Carnegie organ in a church, or they have a library that was funded by him? So you can think of John D. Rockefeller, you know, founder of the University of Chicago, you know. They want to have a lasting legacy. So these are things that are interesting, and they are the latest version of that.
All right. You also got to watch a fun documentary about the movie poster industry. This is called 24 by 36, a movie about movie posters. It came out in 2016.
It did. This I really wish it would have just talked a lot more about how movie posters were originally thought of. So we get a little bit of that at the beginning, but eventually morphs into a group of people who have a passion for painted movie theaters or commercial art, moving in and creating a new movement where they will license the right to do a poster about, you know, a movie that may have come out recently or in the past. Because at one time when we were growing up, Steve, we had movie posters that really, we would look at them, they would be there for months, and all of a sudden we're like, yeah, I want to watch that. And these were painted movie posters. So, you know, back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, they were a certain style. They switched in the 80s and 90s. I mean, think of E.T.'s poster, Star Wars poster, or Raiders of the Lost Ark. These were movie posters that were painted. They were to give you a feeling of the adventure of it. They weren't necessarily of the movie. It may have had something to do with the movie.
Yes.
But really they were to wrap you in, much like a book cover is designed mm-hmm. to do this. And I've been reading a lot of design books recently, and this is just along with that.
We talk a lot about movie posters in the Mystery Science Theater community. The idea of these posters being that first advertisement for these movies, and the movie might be way crummier than the art on that poster. That poster art might draw you in a way that can fund a crummy movie.
Mm-hmm. And so we get a little bit on the history of how that came to be, about how those posters came to be, how they distributed them, and things of that nature. But eventually it moves into the thought of this has been abandoned. And mm-hmm. this was abandoned, I don't know, 1990. I'm throwing in a name. But then it became the floating heads mm-hmm. with something going on. It's a photograph, and that's because they want to see Tom Cruise. They want to see Bruce Willis. They want to see whoever the actor is. And it was just a very different approach and less expensive. It was kind of the rise of Photoshop in many ways.
Right.
You're looking, when you're looking at movies now, you're looking at them on through the Netflix screen or through your, where you want to buy them, through Amazon or whatever. It creates a different way of advertising those movies. And it sort of was abandoned.
I think of all the boxes at the video store. When I worked at the video store and we had all of that beautiful cover art intriguing a customer to pick up that movie because of that cover art, it doesn't work the same on Netflix. That tiny little thumbnail doesn't have to be that much of the story. It just has to be, hey, this is the person in that story instead of the action in that story.
And so a group of people through Alamo Drafthouse, Steve.
One of my favorite places. I wish that we had an Alamo Drafthouse in the Chicagoland area. I'll tell you that much.
We have one in Raleigh, Steve.
Oh, boy.
Just want you to know. Anyway, there was this group of fans who said, well, why don't we make our own posters for the movies showing up? And so that's exactly what they started to do. It started out just sort of as a fun little hobby for them. But eventually it moved into a group of people who they got the rights to be able to do that legally. They create these posters. There are collectors of these posters. And it became a way of for fans to kind of enjoy this lost art is sort of what is going on. And you can imagine, just think about how commercial art impacts your life. You used to look through magazines and you could see pictures and you go, oh, I want to try that chewing gum, or I want to try this, you know, recipe or whatever that thing is.
Mm-hmm.
This is a movie about that. Is it a great film? It's not a great film, but it certainly does address sort of the collectability of time in the past, how it developed. It gives you a nice little presentation on that. It's a documentary. This is interesting. And if you have interest at all in either commercial art or the ability of how to sell movies, this would be a very interesting documentary on some of the artists that got to put these together and also some of the fans who enjoy it.
That sounds awesome. I'm glad that you get to see some interesting documentaries and bring them to us in January and February. Maybe, just maybe, you'll find a movie to watch this week, Chip.
Well, Steve, it's a very big week for me. I mean, it is Valentine's week, and it's about, you know, it's all about love. So we should start off with probably looks like a reasonable movie, and then a whole bunch of stuff that you probably want to forget pretty quickly. So, Steve, let's start off with our first movie being opened this week at the theater.
Yes, this is Death on the Nile, the latest version of the Hercule Poirot story. This is Kenneth Branagh once again directing and starring as Hercule Poirot. We've got Gal Gadot in this one, along with Armie Hammer. This looks like a great film.
Armie Hammer?
Not Armand Hammer. This is his great-grandson. Armand Hammer is dead.
Steve, this movie looks like it's from a period long ago.
Yes, this is very much Kenneth Branagh taking the idea of this Agatha Christie story and giving it to us in a 21st century mode while still retaining all of the age in which it was written.
It looks like a swell movie with an interesting diction, Steve. Yeah, it does look like a movie that was made in the 1950s with modern sensibilities. So anyway, this looks pretty interesting. It's called Death on the Nile. Steve, mm-hmm. show me the stuff that doesn't look as promising.
And then there's the rest of the movies. The first one's called Marry Me. This is a ridiculous premise. This is J-Lo, Jennifer Lopez, Jenny from the Block, is a music superstar who plans to get married on global television, and the person that wins the contest is Owen Wilson. Owen Wilson and J-Lo in love.
Well, we've got a very laid-back Owen Wilson with J-Lo. Which is
not laid back.
All sure. I can say is this doesn't look very good, Steve, but that looks better than probably what our next movie is.
What about love, Chip? What about love? Oh, well, that's the name of this.
This is going to be released on Valentine's Day, not Friday, Steve, on Monday. It okay. stars our favorite Sharon Stone.
And Andy Garcia. This is two young lovers change the lives of their parents forever when the parents learn from the joyful experience of their kids. Have we talked about this one before? Was this one moved back from 2020?
I will guess it was, Steve. It looks awful. So. Let's go with the next one. A movie about a certain set of skills.
And a certain group of tools around the house. This one's called Black Light. It is the next Liam Neeson movie. It looks just like all of the other Liam
Neeson
movies. They're
not typecasting him, Steve, are they? He's stretching out this time. He's a government operative.
Oh, that's much different from what he played in all of the other movies. The last one was called The Commuter. This one's called Black Light. It's like they're naming them based on just looking around the room and seeing what they find.
You know, he's not going to be Qui-Gon, and he's not going to be a big lion. He's going to be a man with a certain set of skills.
That's it. He's got a certain set of skills, and that's all you need to know.
Well, coming to streaming and Blu-ray this week, it looks like there's a cartoon, Steve.
Yep, the DC animated universe keeps on keeping on. This one is called Catwoman Hunted. It is the next story with Catwoman and Batwoman in this one. And Stephanie Beatrice is Batwoman, a very, very sarcastic Batwoman.
Steve, will you be watching this?
I watch most of the DC Animated Universe films. They're not always great, and I don't tend to pay for them. So when this one is available for a reduced rate, I will watch this one eventually. Book it. Brings us to our book of the week. Chip, you have been reading a book that you are super excited about. This is called Wilmington's Lie, The Mysterious Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. Tell us all about this one.
Well, Steve, this is Black History Month. I mean, it's February, my friend.
Yes.
And so it's a good time to go out there and find a book about something interesting about American Black history. And this is a incredibly interesting book. This is by David Zucchino. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2021, basically putting together an account of what really happened. And there's the real challenge of putting this together, is that we have some information, but we don't get all the original sources from all the other people who were impacted. So we need to go back in time. The Civil War ended in 1865, we end up having Reconstruction, and now Wilmington, North Carolina. Wilmington, North Carolina is a coastal port, so if you go down the coast, the eastern coast, you got Boston and New York and Philadelphia. You go down, you got D.C. and Baltimore and D.C. and Norfolk, and then you have Wilmington, North Carolina. So, and you can keep on going down through Charleston and Savannah and Jacksonville, Florida, all the way down to, say, Miami. But Wilmington was a port. It has a history. Pirates were there at one time. It was the last port that was open in the Civil War. That was the one they had. They had blockade runners who basically slip through and bring goods back. It was an area that had a railroad that ran from Wilmington up to the border of Virginia that supplied goods through the Civil War. So this was an area that sort of was, it has a history. And after the Civil War, it was a place where, you know, you get stuff like turpentine that was made in North Carolina. You would get that shipped out to the world. What is interesting is during this time after the Civil War, we had this rising Black middle class, and they were growing, they were becoming wealthy. And what that meant is, because it was growing, this was the largest city in North Carolina at the time. You know, you got railroads coming down, bringing their goods to get out port. So there were jobs that for people who couldn't read, there were jobs for, you know, people just willing to go and do the grunt work that makes America go. And then you've got all these people who've got to support them. And that's where you get the rise of doctors and attorneys and newspapers get created, and people have to feed these people. And this is how wealth is created. So Black people are coming to Wilmington. White people are coming to Wilmington. And this is becoming an educated area. And you have to go back to this 1890s era. Where there was a lot of people who were still illiterate. In fact, the majority of people in North Carolina couldn't read. And so this is, think about where we are today from that point. And you go, wow, it's pretty amazing. Literacy is pretty much a given.
Yeah. It is assumed that everybody that you're talking to is literate. And it's a shock when we find somebody who's struggling with reading, for sure.
So Black people are being elected to go to Raleigh to be in the government. We have people who are Black people who are on the police force. We have people who are doing all the jobs that we would assume that an area that we've got free people would do. And then what we ended up having was a group of people who said, this isn't a good idea. And this group of people came in, and it kind of threw a buildup. And that's what the book does a really good job. It shows the buildup. It shows how much progress had been made from the Civil War, and then where the tensions rose, and then how just a short period of time, I mean, like 2 or 3 days, there's riots going on, and they basically would come to your house. Imagine someone came to your house today and said, hey, Steve, you need to leave. And you're going, wait a minute, what? No, you need to leave now. And you had to grab, I don't know, some clothing, put it in a suitcase. If you were given that, they threw you on a train and they said, okay, Steve, now you're going away. And that's exactly what was going on. And that what they initially did was they got rid of what I would say the middle class, the educated class. They got rid of them. And the city at the end of it recognized the city couldn't run. The people who had skills to get stuff on the boats, to take things off the trains and so on, to make the city work, those Black people were gone. And so they had to coax some of them to come back. They had to say, oh, no, everything's going to be all right. But this is after this coup came in, where they forced the mayor and the alderman to resign. They put in a whole group of people who have white supremacist connections to lead this group. There were people who were killed. They don't know how many Black people were killed during this. Maybe 60. We don't know. What is so fascinating is I don't know how you rectify that. So this is over, 130 years, right? 125, 100. When did we see this happen in another environment? Well, we saw this happen to Jews in Europe, right? The rise of Nazis. They came in, they said, hey, you got to move. And you have to leave now, or you have to go to, you know, this area we set up for you. Well, if you have artwork or something like that, maybe there's a trail that maybe you can go get that trail to get the artwork. For this group of people, you know, they were it was the United States. This was a middle class. They didn't have like super artwork that you could trace back that was something on the international market. It was like your home. It was like your business was taken away. And how do you get back and value that? And then where would a piece of artwork you can return back maybe to an heir of the family. What do you do with a home that may or may not be there now? This is a very important part of learning about American Black history and the experiences they had, about even when there was this opportunity to create, they use something called fusionists here. Fusionists were people who basically were allowing everyone to live. Well, there was this minority here that came in who said, no, this is going to be a white community and you have to leave. And sort of what that meant to the healing of something that is certainly a very a black stain on American history. Other areas learned how Wilmington did this and tried to recreate it in their communities, interestingly enough.
Trying to make a good mixed race community seemed like something that was...
No, Steve. To get rid of people. How to take a growing black population and tell them they can't stay here anymore. This is where you can find that huge migration of black individuals who move from the South, moving up north. You know, there's a group that says these were refugees. Those were not people moving. They were refugees. And that's a pretty reasonable way of looking at it, because when you read this book, you can't help but think their property was stolen from them. Their livelihood was stolen from them. In fact, there's a story that's in the epilogue of this book about a guy who was an attorney, and he was a black man, and he went up to Philadelphia, and he basically was, in many ways, shell-shocked, served as a butler. He hated it. Went to New York City, hated it, worked for a hotel. And finally, he was a white guy, he was an attorney, saw him working at this hotel and said, "What are you doing? You're a trained attorney. Why are you working at this?" And basically woke this guy up. He eventually went down to DC and served as a judge. So, I mean, there's a happiness, but this man's life was stripped from him. In Wilmington, a city, it took him a period of time to kind of come to terms with that. And then it took him, somebody to wake him up, like shake him and say, "Hey, listen, we trained you to be an attorney. Go down and become an attorney. I mean, go down and use it." So he eventually became a judge, which, happy ending, happy-ish ending.
But that particular guy, yeah.
But you can imagine for any other person.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine, I mean, think about an immigrant. You've come from Venezuela today, okay? You're the cab driver. You're the Uber driver. You're the guy. You may have been a doctor in Venezuela, but you're escaping and you're taking whatever you can to make it work. So there's a whole bunch of things I thought about while reading this book. This book was something I plowed through because, first of all, it's a very engaging story. It is certainly something that Americans in general need to be aware of. This mm-hmm. was written out of history. So if you want to know a little bit about why the statues are coming down in the South that were put up, you want to know a little bit about, a lot of this is during that same time. This was sort of that period of time where the Daughters of the Confederacy were making sure that there was a Jeb Stuart statue or Robert E. Lee statue or whatever that thing is. The people who were writing history at that time, they didn't have accounts of the black people that were forced out of their homes. They had it from the people who made it happen. And here's the other part about that is so fascinating for me. So I grew up in North Carolina. I am aware of North Carolina history, but what I don't have is all the history. Mm-hmm. So when you're introduced to history as a young person, this is not the history that I'm getting.
Right.
Okay. Because the black people didn't write down their account. So, but this is what I got to see. I grew up, I used to go to Hugh McRae Park in Wilmington, North Carolina. And it's this beautiful park. When you get to Wilmington, if you want to go and you want to do some skateboarding or walking or play tennis or something, you got this beautiful, well, Hugh McRae was a white supremacist who was one of the people who went in and was part of the government. He made this happen. He made the 1898 coup happen. Well, that was just changed a couple of years ago, probably from this book, or probably because it became aware. When I went to college as a freshman, I stayed in a Charles Aycock dormitory, who eventually, Charles Aycock was a governor of North Carolina. He was part of this. He was part of the government. He is part of what made this happen. And so those buildings that were named after him are taken away. And it is incredibly, you know, and people are saying, well, you're taking away history and things like that. These were not particularly good people. That whatever good they did, you judge them by how they treat people, first of all, who don't have power. And and these people were bad people. And what is so fascinating is they would name places all over eastern part of North Carolina. I know these places. I've been to these places. I didn't realize all that was going on. So when they say Weldon, North Carolina, or Newber, North Carolina, or Spivey's Corner, or Fayetteville, North Carolina, or Raleigh, North Carolina, I know these places because I grew up in these areas. I know Wilmington, North Carolina. When they say it happened on Front Street, I can picture it in my mind exactly where it happened. This is a truly black stain on U.S. history. What I should probably find from this is read a story on, I wish I could find a book that was similar, that's on the Trail of Tears. Because what was done to Native Americans, in addition to what was done to, you know, a group of the black people, was this an inspiration of what ended up happening in Germany? Did they learn how to do it? Now, or is it just part of history that this has always happened? So this is an area that you really have to kind of think about. And it really leads you to all sorts of questions. Well, what I can say is when they talk about the black experience in the United States, you know, first of all, we had slavery and stuff like that. But even freed, once they were freed, the challenges that they've as a community, they've had to overcome. It's been fascinating. And it's something that I think the current generations are writing. But, you know, today's, you know, challenge is the number of people we have in prison.
Right. I
mean, so you take a large population and you demonize them and you put them in
for
prison.
For 120 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no one's alive for 120 years. I mean, very few people. But regardless, it just continues to kind of perpetrate in the latest version of it. So anyway, I do think this is an incredibly important book. If you don't want to read the book, you can go online. You can read about it. There's plenty of articles and videos and stuff like that where they talk a little bit about this because certainly they had to build up. This is an important book. This is a book that, you know, we read the, what is it, the White City about the Chicago World's Fair.
The Devil in the White City. Yeah.
And so that was certainly a good book on the rise of the Chicago that we know and sort of the negative underbelly of this murderer. Wilmington's lies, certainly about the fabric of the city, about how leaving Reconstruction, how we got this prosperous black community going, how it certainly was what we would anticipate in a market-based economy where individuals have rights, and then how a minority can come in and basically through passion, through speeches, through envy, any number of things, basically rip a group's wealth from them and then send them on their way to kind of rebuild their lives. And it is fascinating, truly worthy of your time. This is a good, good book on history that, you know, is going to be uncomfortable just to read.
Winning the 2021 Pulitzer Prize. So a lot of people agree with you that this is an important story that we should be paying attention to. That's Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy by David Zucchino.
Scroll with it.
Brings it to our scroll with it. Chip, we've got Movie Sign. It's important. This is an important week in the Mystery Science Theater 3000 community.
Well, how exciting for you. We've got to watch Mystery Science Theater. Certainly was part of the rise of what Comedy Central, back the original cable show. Because, I mean, my goodness, they could play it all the time. Eventually it went away and then came back through Netflix. And now
Netflix said, nah, we don't really want to produce this anymore. So the community came together and we are making season 13 of Mystery Science Theater 3000. And the community is funding all of this. And we are going to get an app on our phones, on our TVs. And it was rolled out this week. The Mystery Science Theater 3000 app is now available on Apple, Google, Roku, and coming soon to Amazon Fire TV. And the grand opening is going to happen on March 4th with the premiere of Santo in the Treasure of Dracula. The Gizmoplex will be on our TVs and our phones in March.
So that movie is from 1969. Steve, have they previously reviewed this film?
Not this one, no. But Santo was a Mexican wrestler who turned movie star, and some of the other Santo films have been seen through Mystery Science Theater. But Santo in the Treasure of Dracula is the crummy movie of March 2022.
And for those who are not familiar with what this means, Mystery Science Theater was a riffing group. It was a man and his robots who were forced to watch movies. And because they're forced to watch movies and these movies are bad, they make jokes the entire time.
To survive the bad films. Yes.
Steve loves this. There's a whole group of passionate people who love this. And anyway.
And we put millions of dollars together in a Kickstarter to make season 13 happen. And I look forward to talking to all of those creators of this show. We've talked to a lot of them, and the host is still Jonah, except the Joel is coming back to riff a movie in the new season 13, and Emily from the stage show, the live stage show that traveled the country, she's going to get an episode as well.
Well, Steve, you know, that's not the only big exciting news that's coming out. On February 13th in Los Angeles, the Super Bowl will be taking place on Sunday, of course, because no one goes to work on Monday, Steve.
They should really change that. They shouldn't put it on Saturday, shouldn't they? So that everybody can go to work on Monday.
Saturday, but no. In the United States, a Super Bowl Sunday, where all your friends get together, you throw that party, you have a good time. Some people watch the commercials, some people watch the football game, some people just enjoy being around other people.
My wife is very excited about the halftime show this year. The halftime show is an all 90s hip hop. All the stars of that genre of music are going to be on stage for the halftime.
Well, you have a good time watching that. And you also get to see the Cincinnati Bengals, Steve, and the Los Angeles Rams. So,
it's,
you know,
the year of the Tiger.
Well, it is a year of the Tiger.
So that's why the Bengals are going to play.
Which is real exciting. So Cincinnati Bengals, their quarterback is Joe Burrow. And he is a guy from Ohio. He originally went to Ohio State University. He was going to be their quarterback. But he had all these great quarterbacks in front of him, and he never could get the starting job. So his senior year, he graduates from Ohio State, goes to Louisiana State University, LSU, plays for the Tigers, and they win the national championship with him being the quarterback.
So he has
5 years of eligibility. You're allowed to play 4 years in the individual sport. He was a starter for LSU. They win the national championship. They love him down there. His last name is spelled B-U-R-R-O-W. His last game for LSU down in Louisiana, he respells his name, B-U-R-R-E-A-U-X. And the fans went crazy.
On his jersey? They changed it on his jersey?
Yes. Yeah, so that's funny. Oh, it's great because he certainly had a lot of fun. They had this great season. LSU is one of those programs that has all the resources in the world, just like Ohio State. But anyway, he wins the national championship. He is selected in the first round by Cincinnati Bengals. Now, Cincinnati, while they've been in a few Super Bowls, is not the team you want to go play for. You know, certainly it's not the biggest market. They don't really have a history of winning. But it's local boy comes home. And nice. This is his second year, I think, in the NFL. And he's taking Cincinnati to the Super Bowl. So there's this wonderful, story of local boy can't quite get the starting job at Ohio State, transfers to the Tigers down in Louisiana, wins the national championship, gets picked up by Cincinnati. It's not New York, Mm-hmm. And he's taking the team to the Super Bowl. That's a really nice story.
So I look forward to that movie because that you are describing a pretty good football movie right there.
Well, Los Angeles also has a story to tell. They had a quarterback that was sent to Detroit, probably the worst run franchise. Just a team that. Statistically,
struggled.
Everybody should go to the Super Bowl at least once in the history. Detroit has not even sniffed a Super Bowl. They're lucky to get to the playoffs. Anyway, eventually, the quarterback gets traded to Los Angeles or goes to Los Angeles, which has had a franchise there for, I think, 2 or 3 years. They moved back from St. Louis. Anyway, mm-hmm. They're going to the Super Bowl. They're the host of that Super Bowl, interestingly enough.
Second year in a row. Last year was the first time in history that the home team was hosting the Super Bowl. And 2 years in a row, here we are, Los Angeles Rams in the Super Bowl in Los Angeles.
Well, how exciting this could be. So anyway, there's a lot to follow with this, and I hope everyone has a good time. And if not, just get together and have a nice party.
And then go to work on Monday.
Well, Steve, you have to go to work on Monday because you got to go out. What is it, Monday night? It's Valentine's Day.
That's Valentine's Day.
I'm Cupid, my friend. If you got love in your heart, or if you don't have love in your heart, I can give it to you.
That's right. And the way you're giving it to us this week, Chip, is through our Facebook feed. You've got the countdown to Valentine's Day going with all of the love songs that you can. All the love songs you need are there for you on Too Much Scrolling's Facebook page.
Are they love songs, Steve?
I think they're love songs, Chip. I hope that you are choosing appropriate songs for our audience about love and maturity and Valentine's Day.
Well, we look forward to the results of it 9 months from that time.
Oh, everybody always looks forward to our annual love song countdown. I'm so excited to hear from our audience about what joy you have brought them on the Valentine's Day song list this year.
Well, there's a few songs on there I'm sure that everyone will find inspiring.
That's what you do. That's what Eros is for.
People who've got a baby and want to make babies. What can I say?
I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Who's Chip? I'm Cupid. Yes, only if we can come back next week, Steve.
Good. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4TMS. Our website is TooMuchScrolling.com. Our email is TooMuchScrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and YouTube. And you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Cupid, who looks interestingly enough like Harry Styles.
Harry Styles. See you in the future.